and later on at People's Park. The winds that change fanned into flame, student demonstration spark. Down to Isla Vista, where police felt so harassed. They called the special riot squad. The LA County Sheriff was there.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, News Director Rick Spezak. Welcome once again to a new Progressive News Network. Last night, maybe some of you got the message, we did an environmental special. There is a link on the site to it. Make sure you check it out. We did an environmental special when we interviewed people who had were right now are experiencing the West Virginia spill on the Elk River in the Kanawha, and they gave us an update. You'd be very surprised at some of the things going on. And unfortunately, they are continuing to experience new breaks, new leaks. And now, since everybody sort of said that everything's okay, you can use your own judgment. But the water still stinks. People are passing out from fumes. But the public distribution of water has stopped. So now they're depending on each other to help bring water to the communities. Another report we had yesterday, fresh from Tokyo, a German television journalist that we're in touch with gave us information on the latest in Fukushima. It is amazing what's going on over there. He had called us initially and said he would give us 10 or 15 minutes. He just kept telling us some of the things going on, and we ended up being with him for about an hour. It was incredible. And now a little peek into the world of metadata. This is a little comparison of metadata and the American Revolution. Check this out.
Well, this sort of abstract-sounding word really was. Using a few lists of different organizations and their membership at the time of the revolution, the American Revolution, Healy was able to produce a fairly simple map of social relations that showed that a fellow by the name of Paul Revere was more or less the most influential rabble-rouser in all of Massachusetts and likely to be up to something not quite kosher from the English Crown's perspective. Now, for months, the president and his allies have argued against, again and again, that metadata, which is the word that we use to describe this kind of data, that metadata collection isn't much of a privacy threat because the NSA isn't listening in on your calls. They're just looking into who you talk to and how long your calls are, and what's the harm in that anyway?
When it comes to telephone calls, nobody is listening to your telephone calls. The intelligence community is doing is looking at phone numbers and durations of calls. They are not looking at people's names, and they're not looking at content. But by sifting through this so-called metadata, they may identify potential leads with respect to folks who might engage in terrorism.
Well, today's news brings us a blockbuster story from the newly launched website The Intercept that shows just how powerful metadata really is. The NSA is using metadata as, quote, the primary method to locate targets for lethal drone strikes. In other words, metadata is being used right now by the United States government to target people for killing. As in, don't worry, they're not listening to your phone calls, they're just running an algorithm to determine whether they're going to blow someone up. Quote, in one tactic, the NSA geolocates the SIM card or handset of a suspected terrorist mobile phone, enabling the CIA and U.S. military to conduct night raids and drone strikes to kill or capture the individual in possession of the device, which means that we, as a country, are right now targeting and killing individuals without knowing for sure who the person we are killing is, because we are literally targeting SIM cards and blowing up whoever's attached to them. Joining me now, Jeremy Scahill. He just started up a new digital magazine called The Intercept. He's also writer and producer of the film Dirty Wars, which has been nominated for an Academy Award based on his book by the same name. All right, Jeremy, so I think I understand that basically what you're saying in the reporting that you have in The Intercept today is we are actually targeting SIM cards. The thing that we are targeting, the thing that we're going after and sending a drone strike at, is a cell phone, essentially, and a chip inside a cell phone, as opposed to this individual who's 27 and we know trained here and there.
Right. We have a new source, Chris, who worked with the NSA and actually was a drone operator for the Elite Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, of the U.S. military. And he said, you know, people get hung up on this idea that we have a kill list, but actually it's not a kill list. It's a list of either SIM cards or numbers that are associated with handsets. And so when the U.S. military or the CIA are targeting individuals, they don't necessarily know the identity. They just know that they're targeting that phone or that SIM card. And it's a system rife with errors. And, you know, just to emphasize the point you're making, which is a good one about metadata, you can have a scenario where there's these so-called signature strikes where the U.S. doesn't actually know the identity of a person they're intending to kill. They just know that their phone has been in a certain location,
right,
has called other phones on the watch list, or has been, you know, in a mosque or at a particular restaurant. So it's rife with errors, and opens the door for, I think, a lot of the civilian deaths we've seen.
Yeah, that I think there's a whole variety of issues whenever we talk about the targeted killing program in terms of moral ones and constitutional ones and legal ones and efficacy. But let's just narrow in on this narrow question, which I think everyone, there's a consensus that no one wants to see a completely random waiter at a restaurant blown up by a warhead that we sent because he happened to end up with a SIM card that was calling the wrong people. And that is the question here, right? If we don't know who the actual person is, it does seem like there is quite a lot of open space for error there.
Exactly. I mean, we're sort of in this era already of pre-crime where you have President Obama in office. His advisors know that if there's another major attack on the U.S. homeland, that he's political toast. And so what they've sort of done is go way overboard in trying to preempt any potential attack against the United States. And what they've done is, instead of sending actual U.S. operatives on the ground, which would constitute humans or human intelligence, they're relying 90% or more on what's called SIGINT or IMINT, signals intelligence or imagery intelligence. And so what we have are strikes being authorized on the idea that we believe that this phone or this SIM card is associated.
And I'd like to bring on my first guest, Hans Meyer from our Tallahassee group. Tallahassee, Hans, what's up?
Good evening, Rick. How are you tonight?
Very good, sir. Very good.
And I believe this is the first time we've had a chance to chat since the new year, so Happy New Year. I hope it's not too late to impart that greeting along to you.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Very good. Well, a couple of things. Of course, right now, you know, the news, the blogs, everybody's lit up with this business on the hung jury over in Jacksonville, and it really says a lot of things that are that have happened in Tallahassee, that will happen in Tallahassee, and whatnot. And obviously, for those who are unfamiliar, there was what is being referred to as a loud music murder that took place at a Jacksonville convenience store gas station back in 2012, and where a middle-aged, I'm saying, I don't want to say mid-40s, white man objected to the loud music coming from an SUV, which was occupied by four young African-American males. And words led to words, which led to him pulling his gun out and firing all 10 rounds in his clip, seven of which were shot, and three of the bullets killed a young African-American man. And the final three bullets, as the car was actually trying to get away. The jury verdict came out. There were four counts. They convicted him, five counts. They convicted him on four, including three.
Everything but murder.
That's correct, except for murder one, in which they're hung. Now, the state's attorney there has claimed that they're going to be retrying it, and the murder charge. And, you know, more power to them if they do. And if they they do try it and he is convicted, there will be some symmetry to the justice involved, but you know, and it's not necessarily complete justice. But the guy's going to go for a mandatory 60 years, which means he'll be 107 when he gets out. Well, if he lives that long. Well, ironically enough, this was a case of two Florida legislature laws passed that were intended to focus on young African-American males. One, of course, is the mandatory 1020 life law. Now, of course, no legislature would admit this, but the truth of the matter is what they're doing is they're saying if you're a thug and you pull out a gun during a felony crime, you're going to get 10 years mandatory. You fire the weapon, you're going to get 20 years mandatory, and you hit somebody, murder or not, it's 25 years to life. Well, here it's being used against this guy who also was using the Stand Your Ground law, which is...
Don't they also have a clause where if your pants are low, they can add another 10 years?
It may very well be, Rick. I would not be surprised if somewhere in the fine print of the law there's that. But it really hits home that here are two laws that were passed, Alec Litton, I believe, and especially the Stand Your Ground law, lobbied hard by the NRA, and yet it's having the opposite effect in this case, and this one case is having the opposite effect of what it was intended to do. Now, that relates very closely. This whole business relates very closely to Tallahassee. Under the current governor and legislature, I don't even think a new town in Florida would get them to move to change the law. They're just not going to do that. I mean, we're going to live with Stand Your Ground for the foreseeable future, unless... Number one, in 2014, in November of this year, the Floridians vote to kick out Rick Scott. That's a beginning. But what it's really going to take is a sea change in the Florida legislature. And I'm not so sure how that's going to come about.
Hans, I tell you what, I got a simple answer to what's going to stop that law. As soon as a black American shoots a white punk, that law will be out the door fast as you can say Jim Crow lives.
I wish I could believe in you, but there have been African American Floridians who have claimed Stand Your Ground and were convicted. So, you know, it's really – see, what happens is it puts it all – and what did I see on one of the news programs this morning where it's not a stand your ground self-defense. To stand your ground, you must submit to me law. And that's what it really boils down to. And like I said, I don't think it's ever going to change, Rick. And I I'm hoping against hope. But I just don't see it changing any time in the future because even if the governor's office splits, you still have a very strong Republican-led legislature, House and Senate, that, you know, I'm not sure what's going to take. And unfortunately, and I'm not the first person to vocalize this, the Florida Democratic Party just does not seem to have the wherewithal to be able to move this monolith that is the Republican legislature into Democratic hands. I don't know what it's going to take, and it frustrates me. And the ultimate frustration is I really, really fear that let's say that in 2014 a number of seats flipped to Democrat. And let's say that in 2016 both the Florida House and the Florida Senate flipped Democratic. Are they going to have on the top of their list to overturn Stand Your Ground? I doubt it.
Not likely.
And you know why?
Hans?
Because of the fear of the NRA.
Hans, unfortunately, I have to say I need to move on to my next guest. Thank you so much for the Tallahassee Report, sir. And we'll talk to you again soon, okay?
You're most welcome, and I'm looking forward to it, my friend. Have a wonderful day.
Okay,
evening.
Buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome my guest from across the water, Emini Dilik, welcome.
Hi, Richard. Thank you for inviting me again.
Listen, it's our pleasure, my dear. Emini is an author, an essayist, a political activist, publisher of what was your online magazine was what?
Progressive Press.
Progressive Press, an extraordinary piece, something that everyone should check. I think it's on hiatus right now.
No, actually, we do have some. We cover only what is just really going on in the United States for now.
Uh-huh.
But we have new pieces, especially about what's happened in Virginia and all other coal disasters, environmental disasters. So you can visit. And we also have the Facebook page, which we update daily.
Excellent.
So you can visit that as well.
Well, Emily, your office now is in Spain. What's going on in Spain? Give us a heads up on things going on in España.
Okay. Well, the Spain's, as in conservative governments goes everywhere, including in the United States, the Spain currently has a conservative government, and they have new efforts to further restrict abortion. And then, you know, Spaniards, especially, you know, females, women, are up in arms about that. And I just wanted to give you a little bit of background on that. And then I also wanted to talk, you know, about Turkey as well.
Absolutely.
What happened with I just want to give a little bit of background in Spain's political history. Spain's politics has been dominated by two parties after the dictator Franco's death in 1975. So basically, just like in the United States, Republicans and Democrats, you know, how they... every 4 or 8 years they switch. It's the same way it was between the Socialist Party and the People's Party. Socialist Party is basically kind of like the left of Democrats in the United States, and People's Party is very similar to Republicans. Actually, now they're even more conservative, more like the Tea Party people. So Spain has always been one of the most conservative countries when it comes to reproductive rights and abortion. But first legislation was passed in 1985, but that was very restricted. It was only for, you know, rape cases or if the malformations or defects in the fetus. That was the only time you could get abortion. But on March 2010, a new law was expanded because there was the Socialist Party government was in the government at that time. So they wanted to match with the World Health Organization's established sexual and reproductive rules and rights, which basically they removed the restrictions such as rape and health danger requirements. And it was for the first 14 weeks of pregnancy. So you can definitely have abortions in the first 14 weeks without any questions asked. And then they raised it to 22 weeks. The current Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, he's very conservative. And he considered that law that was passed in 2010, he considered it criminal, which is strange because it was against the will of large sectors of the Spanish society, according to him, because in fact, recent polls show that over 80% of Spaniards approved the 2010 law, the extension of the law. So, but the Rajoy's government recently just drafted a new bill, and they put it through the Congress, but it hasn't passed yet. But the draft bill says, basically, it's kind of like a throwback to 1985 law. It says that women can have abortions under two conditions only, if the pregnancy in question is the result of a rape, or if the woman's health is at risk because of the baby she's carrying, and until 22 weeks. So, of course, the women's rights activists and... like I said, 80% of the Spaniards, including a lot of Catholics, actually, they were protesting against it, against this new draft. A lot of people see this new law as a distraction from the economic problems the country is facing. A number of pro-choice demonstrations have been staged in recent weeks. I don't know how much it was covered in CNN or United States, but they were... That's one thing I love about Spaniards. They're very passionate about their rights. And you will see on the streets, raining, snowing, but they go out and they protest. And they make, you know, they affect change. They really do. So the currently the law still needs approval of the parliament, but it's expected to pass because the Popular Party has a large majority for now. So I don't know after that where it's going to go, but this is what's happening in Spain when it comes to women's rights and the reproductive rights and the abortion rights.
Emily, before we leave Spanish politics,
sure.
Could you give – I'm afraid many of our guests aren't familiar with Spanish government. They still have a king and a queen. Is that correct?
Yes, there is a monarchy. Just like in England, monarchs are still – you know, they're kind of representative of their monarchs, royalty, but they don't really have the power as far as, like, legislation or changing laws. Very similar to the English, British.
Now, they came under some criticism because of their expenditures, didn't they?
Of course, yes. Yes, there's a lot of scandals and corruption accusations. There are two major lawsuits going on against them right now. That their allegations saying that they had created NGOs that are not even in existence, and they were using them to basically use taxpayers' money to take vacations, buy expensive things for themselves. So it is, like I told you this before, most of my local friends, 99% of them are against monarchs. But it is such an, I don't know what the word is, it's such an established system that it's so difficult to overturn it now. I think to me, it should have been done by the time the Franco was, you know, the dictator from 1939 to 75. If Franco didn't get rid of them, and right after that, you know, they had few coalition governments, they could have got rid of the monarchy at that time. For some reason, they didn't, but they're definitely against it. They don't like the way, they don't support the monarchs. So I don't know, it will require a major revolution for them to, I think, overturn the monarchs or get rid of them. But they're not fond of their monarchs. They're not proud of their monarchs, let's put it that way. Maybe
okay.
British are a little bit more.
Now, one other question I want to ask you about Spain before we move on to Turkey. Now, I understand that in Britain, there's been some terrible, terrible weather up there. Is Spain
yes.
and the rest of the continent getting this heavy weather also?
Actually, no. I don't know what's going on with Spain. I'm in Madrid, and it is, maybe I should put it that way, it's unusually warm. They are telling me that at this time of the year, it should have been snowing or should be cooler, but we have sun, and it's been sunny and warm, so it's still... My friends think it's something to do with the climate change because it was one of the warmest winters they're experiencing. And I was telling them I brought the sun from Florida. But so, no, nothing major like that has happened yet, thank God. But
okay. Well, now, why don't you tell us what's going on in Turkey?
Okay. Well, the Turkey situation, I wanted to give a little bit of background on the AKP first because some people really... I mean, most of your listeners are aware, but I just wanted to tell them what the ruling party is, who Erdogan is, and what's going on, okay?
Please do.
The ruling party, AKP, the opening of it is called the Justice and Development Party. That party was found in 2001, and their ideology is supposedly moderate Islamist. They were supposed to be the moderate Muslims, right? Very conservative, but moderate. But of course, as someone who knows about the past extremist and fundamentalist ideas and speeches of Erdogan, who is one of the founders of the party and who is the current prime minister of Turkey and the leader of AKP, I knew that was forced. I knew that was the front to get elected because the Turks, although being very conservative people, they're not in general extremists. So in order for this gentleman to be elected, he had to put on a front as being more moderate, more democratic, but in time, he's now starting to show his real colors, right? Because AKP and Erdogan came to power in 2002 elections with that premise, with saying that he's moderate, he's not extremist. But since then, since they came in power, winning all the general elections since then. There are many controversies regarding the elections, by the way. Some journalists and opposition parties wanted investigations into the elections, but it never materialized because the justice system and the police and investigators are basically all AKP infiltrated you know, into the justice system.
Sure.
So I don't know if you're familiar with the Ghazi Park protests that happened last year. And then most recently, in December 2013, Erdogan's government faced the largest corruption allegations ever. There were huge corruption allegations against the AKP cabinet, ministries, and their relatives about taking bribes and using their political power to influence trade agreements, businesses from nepotism charges to outright mafia-like criminal conduct. But AKP's reaction to open investigation has been brutal. Their men in the Justice Department and the local authorities removed over 100 prosecutors who opened this investigation. So the prosecutors are trying to investigate this allegations of corruption. They were removed from their post.
Well, that's pretty bald-faced corruption.
Bold. Very bold. And the hundreds of police chiefs who were did the arrest, they were removed and transferred from their places. So basically that has been this major assault to democracy, freedom of speech. And then the last one, the most recent assault to democracy, is the new internet censorship law that just passed in the Congress. It's waiting for the President Gül's approval. Because the internet is basically the last outlet for the freedom of speech in Turkey right now, because many, many journalists, even artists, are jailed for at least the slightest criticism of the government. So they're all in jail right now. So it's all part of the media intimidation. Of course, it's always disguised under the protection of the public plot.
The homeland.
You know, and he's spying on Americans. You know how they always say, it's all done for our protection, you know.
Right.
But this law is so far-reaching that I call it Orwellian proportions. The law has been met with fierce criticism. It could mean the end for one group of online activists that report on opposition protests, where I learn most of my information. I get most of my information because the regular media is basically completely censored. So the law basically says the law would allow the Turkish telecommunications regulator to block specific social media accounts or specific links on a website, to do so without prior court approval. So they, without court approval, they can just close a website or a Facebook page. And the law also requires internet service providers to store 2 years of customers' online and phone histories, and grants the government largely unhindered access to that information. So meaning government can just ask for that the histories of the customers, and then the internet service providers, they just have to provide it without any prior court approval. So there has been a huge backlash for it. You know, people are on the streets fighting again, just like the Gezi Park, but right now it's waiting for the President Gül's signature. We don't know where it's going to go, but this is the last assault basically for freedom of speech in the country. It's going really bad.
That's incredible. Tell me, how are things in terms of the border with Syria?
The Syrian border, it is actually calmer now because there are negotiations going on for the, you know, between the Syrian government and the opposition forces. So it is definitely calmer than it has ever been. But there is, of course, as you're aware, there are the camps, you know, refugee camps.
Right.
Turkey is providing support for them. Many, many hundreds of thousands of children, families, they are still relying on Turkey's support and aid for that.
We understand there's CIA training and staging areas there as well.
Well, that has been, we first reported that 2 years ago, and then the LA Times reported it, and then now it's well known that the part of the camps, refugee camps, have been used as CIA training facilities, and then Turkey's government helped them to provide that areas, to provide training, provide maybe funding and weapons to the opposition forces.
Well, Emily, thank you so much. Let me bring on my next guest, but if you can stick around, I'd love to have you participate in the roundtable, okay?
Sure, thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. I'd like to welcome Steve Horn. Steve, welcome.
Good to be back.
It's great to hear from you, my friend. So tell me, which of the environmental disasters we're currently facing are you chasing right now?
Actually, it's in your state. I've been following a couple of companion bills in the Florida legislature as of late. One of them is HB 71. The other one is HB 157. So they're both in the House. And together they would do two completely contradictory things. The first one, HB 71,
hey,
would...
Hey, it's Florida for you.
Yes, so it's a bill sponsored by Representative Ray Rodriguez that has passed your committee already. You know, it's supposed to go through the Agriculture and Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee, both companion bills. One of the bills would basically provide disclosure for the chemicals that are injected into the ground during the hydraulic fracturing process. The other one, HB 157, its companion bill, provides trade secrets for the same process. So basically one is disclosure, the other one is complete lack of disclosure, and they're being pushed through together. So it's about as Orwellian as it gets. And it's actually modeled after a bill that was passed in 2011 by the American Legislative Exchange Counselor, Alex. Actually, 2012, I apologize. And it's passed
from the desk of
originally.
The Cokes.
Actually, it was written by ExxonMobil, so not the Cokes, but basically another big corporation. And, that was exposed by the New York Times in an article. And essentially, this bill is passed in Texas and been proposed in a number of other states. And it basically provides this tool called Frac Focus, in which a database is set up for disclosure, so-called. But it's actually owned by a public relations industry called the Michaels Corporation. Actually, not Michaels. Sorry, I forgot the name of it. But this long story short, I'll just say that this bill, Frac Focus itself, has been a complete failure. There's a Harvard study about it last year, and it's going through Florida right now. And, it just goes to show how important the American Legislative Council is, that a lot of these bills do go through states. A lot of people don't even notice them until after they pass. And this is kind of one of them that's flying under the radar right now in Florida.
Well, that's nice. This way you can say to the people who are concerned, say, hey, we got full disclosure. And then to the real people, you say, hey, this is totally covered. That's pretty nice.
Yeah, exactly.
So I understand that the Arkansas spill is still being cleaned up. The two pipeline spills up north are being cleaned up. Of course, the people on the Dan River, they're just cleaning up the river and putting it right back in the coal ash pit that's known to be leaking. What other stories are you tracking right now?
I think besides this Alex story, I'm watching the two-year anniversary right now of, sounds kind of weird that I'm following the anniversary of it, but WikiLeaks just 2 years ago released the Stratfor files, and I've been just as a hook for the two-year anniversary, I'm working on these stories. One of them, I got documents from historical archives at Louisiana State University, actually, where Stratfor started. It was called the Center for Geopolitical Studies at the time, from 1994 to 1996. So I have about 150 documents I got from their archives, and I'm working on a story on kind of the origins of Stratfor for the two-year anniversary. And then I'm also working on another Stratfor-related story, looking at whatever happened to this project that they had created as sort of a subsidiary called StratCap or Stratfor Capital, in which they were trying to capitalize or create a hedge fund basically from their geopolitical analysis or their intelligence gathering operations. And I'm trying to figure out if that ever went through or not. There's a lot of documents on WikiLeaks.
Well, it sounds like you dig up the secrets and you blackmail them to participate in the financial side.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, but so it's a pretty incredible story. There's lots of documents on WikiLeaks, and I've been looking at a number of them, and I'm hoping really to get both out in time for the two-year anniversary. So it's the two-year anniversary is on February 27th, I believe. So coming up on that, it's released on December 27th, 2012. So this will be 2014. Just trying to talk about this organization more because I found them to be very important. A lot of people kind of forgot about that document dump compared to what the Bradley Manning got when he was working for the Pentagon or working for the Department of Defense as a soldier. But the stuff that Jeremy Hammond hacked into is so many interesting stories about the corporate world that have yet to be told with those 5.5 million emails. So that will be one story told from those, and the other one won't be from those at all. It'll just be from the historical archives, but still will tell kind of the precursor, what Stratfor became, and kind of interesting that it was actually headquartered at a university originally. It tells a whole other story of what's the role of universities in American life today, or and what have they been for the past couple of decades.
Well, the state of Florida is basically deciding that if they're not serving some good corporate purpose, what the hell good are they?
Right, and that's, I would say that I think that the documents I have kind of do show the rise of this entrepreneurial kind of corporate university. And really, George Friedman, the CEO of Stratfor and the founder, he's just not the CEO, he's the founder and the chairman, CEO is Shay Morenz. But George Friedman really was going, you know, basically just using the university, the documents do show as a preview, really just as sort of a cheap place for an office space in which he could, he was trying to actually turn it into a for-profit venture on the campus of LSU. So he eventually got booted, and that's kind of the story of kind of everything that's in between there. All the interesting little details will be in my story. But it's a really interesting beginning of Stratfor. That story hasn't really been told at all yet.
Does he have a background in intelligence or military?
Yeah, Friedman has Friedman's background, George Friedman, chairman and founder of Stratfor, originally was an academic, actually. He got his PhD from Dickinson College and just served as an adjunct in a number of places, adjunct professor for a while until he led several universities in different research positions until he founded the Center for Geopolitical Studies at LSU, which lasted for 2 years. And then not too long after that, he moved out to Austin, and then that was the beginning of Stratfor, and it's been around ever since. So it's now going on, a couple of years, it'll be its two-decade anniversary. So it's been around for a while, but it really is a venture that really wasn't really well-known until the WikiLeaks stuff and the hack by anonymous Jeremy Hammond.
You know, I really have to tell you, man, I appreciate that kind of work that you're doing. A lot of people regard, you know, in-depth research like that as, you know, it's just not market ready. I mean, my God, you know, you could be covering starlets right now, Steve. I mean, I don't understand. I've got to go on to my next guest. Can you stick around and join our roundtable at the end?
Yeah, I'll be there. Yep.
Oh, that's great. Okay, listen, I've got to go to my next guest. This is Dennis Campbell, publisher and producer of Worldview on a YouTube channel, an absolutely incredible guy. He also publishes the UK Progressive. So if you guys hang on there, I will move on to our next guest, Mr. Dennis Campbell. Let's see here. Here we go. Da, 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 da. Here we go. Dennis Campbell, right from Britain. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to welcome the charming, the talented, international raconteur and political commentator, Mr. Dennis Campbell, a host and senior producer of Worldview and also publisher of UK Progressive. Dennis, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rick.
My pleasure. Dennis, it's been a while since we talked. What's on your plate right now?
We've been in the midst of this now for the better part of a month of some pretty horrific weather that I'm sure does not get much coverage there. And that has led to some very serious flooding in parts of this country, largely due to the fact that the UK government has slashed every budget you can possibly think of to the bone, including that for flood defenses. Nick Clegg, who represents one of the other political parties that is in the coalition government, but is also the deputy prime minister, stood in the middle of a field up to his knees in water and said, now is not the time to be pointing fingers of blame, which of course begs the question, then when is? Because we really have got a government that has turned around and said basically the environment just doesn't matter. They're going to do everything they can to frack anywhere they can. And they're running into resistance, so much so that it was very heartening to see a couple of days ago that the oil giant BP, which used to stand for British Petroleum many years ago, has decided that they're not going to invest in fracking because there is so much opposition to it. So long and short of it is, we seem to be winning the battle ever so slowly, but we're going up against opponents in both industry and government that have a lot of money and a lot of power and are learning that, you know, when you come up against the will of the people, that is not any good either. The other thing that the Cameron government is hoping to do is invest in a number of 600,000 pound, that's $1 million, water cannons, which makes us wonder, are we indeed living in the United Kingdom or are we living in Egypt? Because their plan is to use them to disperse crowds. And the quote that was made when they first presented them was to disperse crowds who may be gathering in opposition to the policies of the current Tory government. So that's just a brief history of what's going on here in this country.
We have an interesting test of that odd paradigm where there are those who say we don't need regulations, and the good state of West Virginia is reaping the benefits of exactly that kind of government and exactly that kind of thinking. So the question I've asked time and time again of West Virginia activists and West Virginia journalists is, how's that no regulation working out?
Yeah, the nanny state is quite an interesting thing because, you know, I've been following this West Virginia water story, and it only seems to get worse because apparently we're recording this on a Wednesday for your Sunday evening program, but on Monday evening's Rachel Maddow show, there was a story about not only do you have to worry about what chemicals are in your water supply, but you've also got the coal ash situation.
Right.
And you know, now you've got a coal ash spill, you know, and coal is king in West Virginia, has always been, and can do no wrong. So you start to wonder at what point in time does the citizenry wake up and say, you know, the EPA are not a bunch of jackbooted thugs that are trying to destroy the economy. They're actually trying to protect the health and safety of everybody. You know, and Sheila Jackson did an absolutely fabulous job there for the years that she was there. And, you know, we really need to get back on a footing that says, you know, the environment is important and worrying about, you know, what is happening, what chemicals are being stored where. This is all holdovers from the, you know, the Cheney regime that pretty much gutted the EPA and neutered it.
Well, recently it came up that the two senators have quite different stands. Jay Rockefeller has stated again and again on live television interviews that he doesn't trust anybody there and the water is not safe. He wouldn't drink it if they paid him. And to show the other side of the coin, Joe Manchin was actually in a campaign commercial that he recorded. He was seen shooting a rifle into the book of regulations of the EPA.
Oh, that was when he was first running. Yeah,
right, right, right. So you know, we still have both sides of that. And as you pointed out, the coal ash spill also. And people have made the point over here that, gee, if terrorists had poisoned the water supply, everybody would be all on top of this. But since it was homegrown job creators, well, it seems that they can do no wrong and it's no big deal. And one of the West Virginia health officials said, well, you could always ask your local doctor because clearly they have more resources than the state of West Virginia or the EPA or the CDC. And if it wasn't such a disastrous response, it would be funny. But unfortunately, it's not. And the CDC has commented that, well, they base their one part per million comment that everything's fine as long as it's one part per million or less on the original research done by Kodak when they invented this product. So nothing like depending on the poisoner to see just how safe everything is. But
you remind me when you say one part per million, you know, being safe. I'm going to tell a story that you know, back in the days when my wife and I had decided we had enough children and it was time for me to go for the, you know, well-known baby-preventing procedure that men can have. and that procedure was completed, and then the doctor was cross-checking and tabulating, you know, the results of a post-operative sperm test. The Dutch doctor said on the form that the word enkele appeared, which meant a few. And I said to the doctor, well, how many is a few? And, you know, because we'd had three children 16 months apart, he said, sir, in your case, one is too many. So I don't think we're too far off with some of these chemicals when we say one part per million is one part too many.
Yeah. The Syrian situation is clearly going to hell in a handbasket faster than you can say, oh, I don't know, Cameron. And we've narrowly avoided a war once. Do you think we'll be able to sustain this non-war condition, or at least not open war?
I don't think we'll ever go to war in Syria. I think the big issue and the big fear everyone should have, and you know, I said this towards the end of last year, and I said this all during 2013, is Iran. I think that we are kidding ourselves if we think they're going to change their stripes dramatically. I think it's very brave to try and go for a nonviolent solution, but the drumbeat of war, the drumbeat of conflict continues across Washington, D.C., and it's very scary to watch. And, you know, as President Obama brings us out of yet a second war, you know, and it looks like Karzai is not even going to sign the agreement, so we'll be out of there even quicker, which is fine by me. You know, the drumbeat of war to keep the industrial machine going is extraordinarily scary. I mean, the first sign of a hiccup or a problem, and you know that McCain and Graham and all of the hawks are going to be lining up with the neocons to, you know, say bomb now, and Israel will probably be the ones to do it, and we'll probably have to give them cover. It's terrible. And the other issue that nobody talks about, but it's the one that scares me even more than Iran, is a potential conflict between Japan and China. That one will involve us as well. Yeah, the Japan and China situation is quite scary because nobody knows what the end game is or why. And you know, of course, post-World War II, the military in Japan is almost non-existent. And, you know, be basically a walkover for China. And if that happens and they do attack, then, you know, we're under obligation to defend them. It's just not a situation you want to be stuck in the middle of. And the wild card there is, you know, the great young one, Kim Jong-un in North Korea. So that is a region of the world, even though we have a long history in the southeastern part of it, you know, with Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia and,
sure,
and all that area. You don't want to be mucking about in a battle between Japan, China, North and South Korea, as it has tremendous consequences. We had a woman on our program, Dr. Marsden, and she was amazing. She really talked about the impact of nuclear war today, because that's probably where it would go, versus when the bombs were dropped 50 years ago in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, 60 years ago, excuse me, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And she was basically talking about the way cities are built up today and all the concrete structures, far more so than you saw back then. It is really a potential for not just the radiation and the devastation would cause in the ground, but the amount of pulverized dust and concrete ash that would then go up into the upper levels of the atmosphere. So that could really could block out the sun's rays from hitting the earth and could cause a premature ice age. And really scary stuff.
Yeah, of course we see the Turkish government going in some very dangerous directions too right now.
Indeed, and I've become very, very, very close with several members. These are a group of actors and directors and writers that have moved to this part of the world that were part of the original Gezi Park uprising. And I've had the chance to break bread with them on several occasions and just get to know them. And you know, they're very passionate about the way in which their government has mishandled this situation. It's labeled them as terrorists, and these are some of the most peaceful, artistic lovely people you'd ever want to meet, yet the government has used social media, state media, to paint them into a corner. It's really funny to walk down the street with this group because they're so well recognized as either movie or television stars in Turkey that anytime you come across a Turkish person, they run up to them to say hello and, you know, get a photo taken and things like that. So it's kind of like walking down the street with Brad Pitt in Los Angeles, I would imagine it to be.
You know, the other thing I want to mention is clearly the attacks on the press. You know, you've got The Guardian doing just great work exposing some of these deep, dark secrets of the rogue state and its minions and collaborators. That episode of drilling the hard drives, which was so much for show, how is this looked on in the British media? Is this, oh my God, you know, they're overreacting, or is this really casting a chill on those who would publish state secrets?
I don't know the answer to that question, Rick. I mean, I'm still so torn on Edward Snowden. Yes, he broke the law, but the only way what he could release could come out was if he broke the law. Is he a hero? I'm not so sure. Is he the spy and villain that everybody wants him to be made out to be? Probably not. Are his motives pure? I don't know. But the one thing he has done is started a debate on a global basis about the way in which data is stored. And no more do we see it now than during the current Winter Olympic Games in Sochi. I mean, there have been, you know, what was it that the head of security said? He said, well, we know you people are making stories up because we see you on our cameras turning the showers towards the wall and leaving the room. wait a minute. You know, and Richard Engel's, story on NBC about, you know, opening a MacBook Air and an iPhone from the box, basically, and watching them be hacked and attacked. Governments have state secrets. They have them for a reason. We may not always agree on the reasons why they do it, but the mass collection of data and the way in which it's been gone about by both the United States and the United Kingdom is just plain wrong. And I don't think anybody, when we looked at things like the Patriot Act and some of the post 9/11 reaction, could have imagined where we are today. I interviewed, had the wonderful privilege to interview Representative Keith Ellison from Minnesota,
uh-huh,
for Bookview TV, and it's still up there. We ended up talking for about 35 minutes. It became the entire show about his new book, My Country, 'Tis of Thee. And, you know, we need more progressive lawmakers like Representative Ellison. I mean, this guy, he's in the job doing it for all of the right reasons, for peace, for social justice, for finding a better way forward. He gets mocked by others in the, you know, in the more traditional pursuit of graft and, influence and snark and ratings. He's just solid all around. And if you really want to see how this guy thinks, you know, his book is very good, and it was really good to go into and understand how he became who he is today and what he's had to overcome in terms of that right-wing noise machine that's out there. There's so much that is going to be better this cycle, I think. I honestly believe people are tired of snark. They're tired of sarcasm. And if we're going to succeed on the left in changing, we've got to stop just taking pot shots at the right. We've got to find a way to put solutions on the table that are real. We can't just identify the problem, but to come up with solutions.
Thank you so much, Dennis, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
All the best.
That was Dennis Campbell, direct from the UK. And now my next guest, Tony Knoll of NPA, New Progressive Alliance.
How's it going,
Tony? Welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be back. How are you?
Very good, sir. Very good. And yourself?
But never better.
That's great. So, Tony,
despite
what's
all the
new
coal
in...
ash in the water here in North Carolina.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, I thought you were. I thought maybe that might come up, just even in passing. Boy, what a bunch of morons we've got running the energy company, huh?
Yeah, Duke Energy. Yeah, yeah. I love the way they said, yeah, you know, the leak continues. They don't know really when they're going to stop it, so they're digging it out of the river, putting it back in the continuing to leak pond. You got to have some real geniuses involved in that.
Yes, isn't that true? And you know, again, and I guess maybe, you know, I know you've been talking about this pretty consistently throughout the show already, but just, again, to sort of quantify this for people, the early estimate soon after this first pipe break occurred was the equivalent of somewhere between 400 and 700 rail cars of wet coal ash that went into this public drinking water source.
My God.
Yeah, and... you know, what I've been able to find since, and I know you're going to ask me, well, how many railroad cars does it take to fill an Olympic-sized pool?
You've got my number, Tony.
And I don't have an answer for you, but they've since, you know, I guess because the Olympics are in the news now, they're now, you know, making it equivalent to Olympic-sized swimming pools. So it's between 20 and 32. You know, if I were permitted that kind of margin of error in my job, Lord, it just boggles the mind. But anyway, so
now I do understand
there's
criminal charges being talked about. Anyway,
they are being talked about, and just to give listeners, and again, I'm not sure quite. I joined the call a little bit late, so I'm not quite sure if you've gone into this amount of detail. But to give them a little background on the history of this, how
please
it's worked in North Carolina prior to this spill. Environmental groups, when there was an environmental incident, environmental groups would raise a great hue and cry, and they would go to the state Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, the DCNR. And what would happen was basically the DCNR would turn around, slap the utility on the wrist. And that would be the end of it. And the environmentalists have really had their fill of that. And, of course, this is a catastrophe that you can't just issue a slap on the wrist. It's the magnitude is too great. So the DCNR immediately, once that was exposed, you know, this long history of their ability to bury these issues in the past, They came out with a very strong line, you know, saying that they were going to get to the bottom of this, yada, yada, yada.
But Tony, but wasn't it a really strongly worded condemnation letter?
It was strongly worded, and I guess we should be thankful for that. And I'm serious. I'm really not being too sarcastic with that. I guess we should be thankful for it, But you know, I'm a transplant here in North Carolina. I came from Pennsylvania about 10 years ago now, and in all of my years working as a journalist, and even before that in Pennsylvania, just you know, as a kid coming up, I paid attention to the news, and all that you had to do in Pennsylvania, if you were a utility and you wanted a rate increase, was to ask for twice what you wanted. Then it went to the Public Utility Commission, and they made a fantastic show of holding public hearings on this proposed rate increase. And then they consistently awarded whatever half the amount was. So the utility companies knew what was going on. The people didn't have a long-term enough memory to sort of put two and two together. This was before environmental awareness is where it is now. And, you know, I just don't trust state agencies. Call me crazy. But I don't. I think that they exist to grease the wheels for business and to put a happy face on what they do for public consumption. So, you know, everybody talks such a fantastic game about transparency in government, and I think the first place we have to look is to our local governments and then to our state governments. But, you know, another story that's come out, I don't know if you've talked about this, but Pat McCrory, our wonderful governor here in the great state of North Carolina,
go ahead.
Was a former 28-year employee of Duke Energy. And on Friday, this is somewhat new portion of this story, after refusing to answer phone calls from reporters about whether he might have been involved in a proposal to make a lot of Duke's violations go away, someone cornered him at a public event and asked him, and he denied it. But the reporting, and this is mainstream reporting, so, you know, hats off to him. I don't get to say that too often, but the AP reported on Friday that there was a deal that the administration had been working on, which has since been scuttled, of course, in view of this latest spill, that would have essentially settled all the environmental violations that Duke had committed. And again, Duke McCrory's former employer, at two of their coal ash dumps, $50 billion worth, for $99,000.
So, yeah, I think a lot of times with these revolving doors, they outsource some employees briefly to give them a rest, you know, to have them see from the other side so they can learn what laws they can circumvent better.
I think you're right, and of course the only problem with McCrory is based on his public persona, at least I'm not so sure learning is even within his realm of possibility. But yeah, it's been a really interesting couple of weeks here in North Carolina.
And now understand that your Moral Mondays is still continuing.
They are indeed, and they're going to be kind of amping up again here in the month of February. This has made a lot of news, of course, all over, partly, I would guess, because it's happening in North Carolina. You know, we are not a state with a very high tolerance for anything that people would consider left, and in most cases, not even for what most people would consider reasonable. If it greases the wheel of what the big corporations want to do, we're all about it here in NC, and if it doesn't, it must be lefty commie stuff.
Amazing.
Yeah,
so let me ask you this. This is such a high pro. I was kind of surprised. I actually heard a mention on CNN about the West Virginia issue after, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks of no coverage at all. And I understand that Rachel Maddow did cover it briefly. Do you think they're going to be able to whitewash this? They're going to be able to just get away with it? You know, give them a $5 fine and a really strongly worded letter?
See, for me, the question is really greater than that, Rick. And while I appreciate it and that we need to sort of be, you know, thinking, well, we definitely need to be thinking about accountability here. The problem is that the public has been so conditioned by the mainstream mass media to sort of pay attention from one crisis to the next. The crises have been prevalent and increasing enough that I think all of us are hoping that it's going to be hard to start ignoring them or whitewashing anything. And that these things, you know, such as the blowout in the Gulf a few years ago and now this, and you know, let's not even get into tar sands and how the pipeline already exists, guys. They're just using railroad cars. Hopefully there is enough awareness growing around the country of what's being done to the environment for a few more dollars or a few dollars more, if I get all Eastwood on you, is not only unconscionable, but needs to be addressed in a systemic kind of way.
I was asking, I interviewed some activists yesterday from West Virginia, and I said, you know, we expect from red states like, well, you know, Florida and almost everybody else, that what you're going to get is the proverbial watch what we're doing. My God, it's incredible. And then you end up with something like the guy from BP who destroyed all those emails, you know, getting a $1,000 fine and suspended sentence. You wonder, is the right going to come back and say, be able to say with a straight face, hey, we don't need regulations. Were they able to get away with that in West Virginia? And they said, well, not yet. And I asked if the Teflon Roots activists are coming out yet, or the, you know, the coal industry funded people coming out saying, hey, you know, we need to protect our job protectors, not job creators, not destroy them. And, you know, you wonder, what does it take? What does it take for people to say it. And I think in West Virginia, they've come to a point where if you can't drink the water, if you can't drink the water, as Senator Nelson Rockefeller, or Senator Jay Rockefeller said, you know, the place becomes uninhabitable if you can't drink the water.
That's right. That's right. And I do think water issues are going to lead the way in the environmental fight as we move forward.
Well, Tony, you can be able to stay with us for the roundtable at the end?
I would love to. Thank you, sir.
Oh, please do. Please do. So I'm going to bring on my next guest. Thanks so much, Tony, for that update from the Carolinas. And I'd like to bring on now Mr. Alan Mackey. Alan, welcome,
Hi.
Sir.
How are you doing?
Very good, sir. Very good. You come to us from the upper Midwest, is Minnesota, right?
Right.
Northern so, sir, Minnesota. Tell us, what are you focusing on up there in Minnesota right now?
Well, we've been working on organizing progressive forums while bringing progressives together around the minimum wage issue for peace, for health care, real health care reform. And we had a nice conference here yesterday with about 50 people in Minneapolis. And about several weeks before that, we had a big conference with about 140 people in Duluth on the same types of issues. So my focus has been on these organizing these forums, conferences.
Well, that's great. That's great. At these forums, you know, you were talking about economic justice. You're talking about, do I gather, environmental issues as well?
Oh, yeah, there's a big environmental issue going on here in Minnesota right now. There's a company called Polymet that wants to start sulfide mining in northern Minnesota, and it's facing major opposition, drawing thousands of people out in opposition to it. What they want to do is put in a copper-nickel mine, and the waste would be this sulfide that goes into all the rivers and lakes and streams in northern Minnesota and flows north even into Canada. So people have been in big opposition to this. People are demanding that the mining companies put up enough money in case there's environmental damage that they have to take care of it. But what the DNR is saying is that the mining operation may last 20 years, but they'll have to keep monitoring the water and have some kind of system that prevents pollution that will have to stay in operation for anywhere from 200 to 500 years. So this is a major expense, yeah. And it's almost unbelievable that they would allow something like this to take place, but it looks like they're going to go ahead with it. The governor of Minnesota, Mark Dayton, a Democratic governor, and we have a supermajority here with the Democratic governor, the Democratic state legislature, and the Democratic Senate. They all seem to want to let this mining operation go ahead. And one of the major oppositions to this is that the existing miners, we have what they call the Iron Range here in Minnesota, where most of this country's iron ore comes from to make steel. And these companies left and right have been swindling these miners out of their pensions. For years this has been going on. LTV declared bankruptcy and swindled thousands of miners out of their pensions on the Iron Range. We have got National Steel. They've been swindling hundreds of miners out of their pensions. And these politicians are going to let another mining company come in without even taking care of the problems of the pensions of the existing miners. So, you know, these politicians are just in bed with the corporations, and no matter what issue you talk about, whether it's the minimum wage or this mining issue. On the minimum wage, we had Democrats elected claiming that they were going to support and legislate a real living wage as the minimum wage. Now they're coming forward, and they can't even agree if the minimum wage should be $8 an hour or $9.50 an hour. You know, pitiful poverty wages, and it's just terrible.
And I'm sure they're making the old proverbial case that this is job creation, and these are good-paying jobs. The pollution aside, you won't need to drink water, I guess.
Exactly. We have one of the largest freshwater aquifers in the world here in Minnesota, and they're destroying it left and right. This mining operation will destroy an entire aquifer, and this is by the DNR's own admission. It's going to pollute an entire river and lake system in about a quarter of northern Minnesota, a pristine area right now. And, you know, this just goes on. There's no end to these kinds of hideous projects. And you are right. They say jobs, jobs, jobs. They're always talking about jobs. But, you know, I work with casino workers, and the biggest job creation program that's ever taken place in recent history in Minnesota has been the Indian gaming industry that now employs 44,000 workers working in smoke-filled casinos, loud, noisy smoke-filled casinos at poverty wages and without any rights under state or federal or tribal labor laws. These are the kinds of jobs they're creating. Not only that, the Democrats have brought Menards in to northern Minnesota. These jobs are paying like $8.50 an hour, and people are getting like 12 to 14 hours a week of work. You know, this is a terrible situation, and yet these Democrats say jobs, 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 and they keep talking about good jobs and well-paying jobs. We aren't seeing any well-paying jobs, and there's no reason why every single job shouldn't be a good job and a well-paying job, but they lack taking the action to create these jobs that are good jobs and well-paying jobs. They could raise the minimum wage. There's no way the Republicans could oppose them. They could raise the minimum wage to a real living wage, somewhere around $15 an hour or more, and this is what they promised. They promised a non-poverty minimum wage, and we're not getting that out of them. We're getting another poverty wage.
You know, Alan, you've been working on union issues and organizing people for a long time. What do you think was it that prevented Tennessee auto workers from getting some protection in the workplace?
Well, first of all, you know, Obama sort of came into the struggle, but, you know, like they say, a day late. And the main thing,
though,
is that...
He was the picket line, remember? I remember that.
Yeah, he lost his walking shoes or something. But, yeah, he did say he was going to start walking the picket lines and put on his marching shoes and join with labor and everything. He hasn't done that. We had a massive lockout here at American Crystal Sugar in northern Minnesota. He did nothing. We've seen lockouts all over the country. Obama and the Democrats have done nothing. In Tennessee, you're talking about the Volkswagen plant.
Right.
And I think one of the main reasons that we're seeing workers turning down the union organization is because the unions themselves haven't adequately represented the workers that are paying dues right now. And workers look at this and say, hey, do we really want this? And I don't think the unions have been setting a good example when it comes to organizing because they haven't been taking care of the members that they have. We've seen concession after concession. That's all that these labor leaders like Bob King from the UAW, the only thing he can negotiate is a concession contract. Well, you know, common sense says, you know, if you're a worker and you're trying to organize a union, is this the kind of union you really want representing you? And I think workers are looking at that. We see that with Walmart workers. They're trying to decide what union they want to go with. They see unions like United Food and Commercial Workers that have poverty wage contracts all over the country, so they're not sure if they want to go with a union like that. I think that workers are going to have to start to take action themselves and organize their own rank-and-file-based unions, just like what was done in the 1930s. That's how we got the industrial unions. These industrial unions today have been taken over by, I think, a lot of them are company moles where the companies have actually put
sure.
their own people into union leadership positions. That's
sure.
my opinion of Bob King. That's my opinion of Richard Trumka. They're bringing Richard Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, here into Minnesota to speak at the Humphrey Center later this week. And they're bringing him here to push for this $9.50 minimum wage. Here you have a millionaire labor leader, and I'm not... saying this out of any kind of sarcasm or anything, but he's a millionaire. He's a millionaire labor leader, and he's coming to Minnesota to try and shove a $9.50 an hour poverty wage down our throats. This is just plain wrong. What kind of people, you know, organizing in their workplaces are going to want to affiliate themselves with a person like that? And
well, I remember hearing in 2008 that union people were saying, hey, look, we're not going to take this kind of no help from the Democrats and just roll over for it. We're going to insist. Where the hell is he insisting? Where's the backbone going on? Obviously, Democrats in office have none. I thought the union was going to provide that background. They've got people. They've got money.
That's what we were told, just like Obama said he was going to put on his marching shoes. We were told by Richard Trumka and Leo Gerard and these people, Jimmy Hoffa, that they were going to light a fire under Obama's feet and get him to do what labor wanted him to do. We've never seen that. They never even lit the match, you know, and this is a big part of the problem. And they talk real big and militant. You know, Richard Trumka can give the nicest speeches, just like Barack Obama. But when it comes to real action, you know, they're AWOL. They're absent. We don't see them any place around. They give their speeches. They hold a press conference. And that's the end of the so-called struggle. There is no attempt to mobilize people in this country to achieve any kind of real reforms.
When I saw those incredible, wonderful workers gathering together in Wisconsin, I wondered, where the hell is the union leadership? Why aren't they behind them? Why aren't union men and women from across the northern, at least from the northeast, for God's sakes, at least from the north central part of the state, why isn't everyone rushing to the aid of these Wisconsin people? And I didn't see it, and I couldn't understand why it wasn't happening.
Well, many of us went there. I was invited to speak there, and I was turned away on orders of Leo Gerard. Leo Gerard told workers in Wisconsin that if I was allowed to speak at a rally there, that the AFL-CIO would withdraw support. You know, this is the kind of thing that goes on, and it wasn't just me. It was many other people that were denied the right to speak. Some of our casino workers were actually turned away because they had signs promoting the rights of casino workers. And some of them were carrying signs that says, "How is Barack Obama's Wall Street war economy working for you?" And, they were greeted at the door and told by these union big shots that they would not be allowed to come in to the Capitol building with these signs. You know, this is ridiculous.
You clearly care too much about workers. That was your problem. Alan, listen, can you stick around for the roundtable at the end, buddy?
Sure, I can.
Excellent, excellent. Let me bring on my next guest. Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome our next guest. Is this Anita?
Yes, this is Anita. Can you hear me?
I sure can, Anita. Welcome, welcome. Glad you could join us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Anita, you know, we're talking about environmental issues, labor issues. What issues are you bringing us tonight?
Oh, there. You know, I feel like we the people are just under constant assault by our government and really the government / corporations, which when you look around, it's really one and the same anymore. I think the most important things here in Florida, of course, are the stand your ground and the justice. It's almost like it's an open hunting season on young black men and boys here in the state of Florida with the outcome of the Michael Dunn trial in Jacksonville. That's just one big issue. The next big issue, I think, is the fracking that's set to start in and around Naples, Florida. There is a huge meeting coming up, which is going to be an open forum with the EPA, and that's happening down in Naples at the Golden Gate Community Center Auditorium on March 11th from 4 p.m. to 8:30 p.m., and the organizers there want to fill the room. So they're asking people to come from all over the state to witness, you know, what the EPA is going to discuss. I'm hoping they allow the public to speak at this event as well. I'm not sure. Yeah, it's a bit. We just don't know. What we're not sure of is how many people actually understand what acid fracking is, because that's what they want to do down in Naples. 1,000 feet from a residence, contiguous, right next to the Panther Reserve, the Panther Wildlife Reserve, and right next to the Everglades. So I was going to kind of give like a short description on what acid fracking is.
Sure.
And
you,
what makes it a little bit different.
Do you know what time that event is? Do you know what time that event is?
Oh, yes. Let me go back. 4 p.m. till 8:30 p.m. Golden Gate Community Center Auditorium. That's 4701 Golden Gate Parkway in Naples, Florida. And if you're using GPS, the zip is 34116.
Thanks. Yeah, go ahead and explain acid.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, go ahead and explain the acid fracking.
Acid fracking is an aggressive process for extracting oil trapped thousands of feet below the Earth's surface. Modern, unconventional, or enhanced techniques have made this gas and oil recoverable. In regular fracking, 2 to 9 million gallons of water mixed with sand and chemicals are exploded into the ground to crack the bedrock. In acid fracking, thousands of gallons of hydrochloric acid are pumped into the well to dissolve the rock. In acid fracking, which is more likely in Florida's limestone bedrock, hydrochloric acid would be pumped into the well to dissolve it. And in either case, the fracking fluids and the subsequent hazardous wastewater from oil production would be pumped into a disposal well beneath the water aquifers that supply Naples and Collier County with drinking water. 20 barrels of toxic wastewater will be pumped into each disposal well for every barrel of oil produced. So this is what makes acid fracking a lot different than regular fracking. And also, they call this process that they want to use in Naples horizontal drilling, which is also slightly different. And the contaminants would include radon, benzene, and other volatile hydrocarbons. So benzene is known is a known carcinogen, and at concentrations as low as one part per billion. Toluene.
Now, if I'm not mistaken,
go ahead.
I was just gonna mention. I heard that the state has ruled that even though it's protected lands, drilling is no problem at all. Isn't that correct?
Right, and this is one of the things that most people, homeowners, property owners here in Florida don't seem to understand, or maybe they're just not, they're hearing it, but they don't want to believe it. If you own property and you do not own the mineral rights and the water rights under the ground, underneath your home, underneath your property, you are stuck like Chuck, because that means anybody can come in, any of these corporations, and they can put a well right on your land, because you own the land, but they own what's underneath. And this is free to the highest bidder. If an oil company doesn't own it, an oil company can buy it. Somebody owns those mineral and water rights that are under your property. So people that own property, they better pull out their deed and they better look and see what they've got, because if you don't have that written on the deed, you don't own it, and anybody else can buy it.
Now,
so,
there are a few state officials who've been standing up in opposition to this. If you know who those people are, we should also try to get some public support for them as well. I know not Mr. Meeks, but there was another gentleman who was working with, I know, the Naples people. Name escapes me right now.
Okay. We did do a show on the table with the Green Party last, I think it was a week and a half ago, and I was on it along with Don Loritz and Joe Mule, who is the president of PreserveOurParadise.org. So for anybody listening out there that would like to know more about what's happening in Naples, that would be the go-to website to get more information. PreserveOurParadise.org would be it. And it's this is very frightening, because somebody kind of popped onto my Facebook page the other day, and for those of you that remember him, he was an outspoken brigadier general during the Katrina thing, and he was a spokesperson on CNN. His name is General Russell Honoré. He's retired. And he's been working quite closely with victims of the Gulf oil spill in Louisiana, where he comes from, and the big salt dome sinkhole in Assumption Parish, Louisiana. And he said right on my Facebook page, if you allow them to drill in Florida just one well, then they're going to keep going. If they can do it in one place, they're going to keep going and do it in multiple places. So he said, don't let them start. Don't even let them put one well in. So,
well, since we have such a very high water table, it would seem odd that they'd be able to get the rights to put more wells down, underneath the water supply, especially since there's seawater down there.
Exactly. And we have the saltwater intrusion and all of this. It defies comprehension. And the only thing that I can assign to it, the only word that I can assign to it is greed, pure unadulterated greed. There's big money to be had, but the oil that would come out of the Sunnyland Trend, which is it's an area that is kind of diagonal. If you look at a map of southern Florida, it's diagonal from Naples down to Miami, and it intersects the Everglades. And the amount of oil there is minimal, and it's not even good quality. But a lot of these wells were abandoned right around the 1940s during the Second World War and after. There was a small amount of drilling there, and then the wells were abandoned. And this, the oil that would come out of there would not even justify the money that they're going to spend to get it out of there. So none of it seems to make any sense at all.
And, of course, since water is a very precious and limited quantity, it would seem kind of foolish to destroy water, especially where there's so much chance of it polluting more than one resource.
Exactly. There's now, I've just mentioned the EPA event in Naples, but on Tuesday there is a statewide clean water rally in Tallahassee that I wanted to let people know about. It doesn't matter what group you're with, what party you're with. It has no bearing at all. But people are meeting at the Capitol. I'm going to get the information here. I've got it. Let's see. We Want Clean Water Rally. Let's rally and tally. It's Tuesday, February 18th, 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. on the front steps of the old Capitol, 400 South Monroe Street, Tallahassee, Florida. For GPS users, 32399. There are buses going. There's buses leaving from Naples, Fort Myers, Sarasota, St. Petersburg, Tampa, Gainesville, and Orlando. And you can get more information to the website wewantcleanwater.com. This is a website for the Floridians Clean Water Declaration Campaign. And the very first link on the task bar at the top is Rally and Tally, February 18th. Click there, and that will give you all the information about this event. The event's also on Facebook under Statewide Clean Water Rally. So people need to step up for our water, and these are two big issues, the Clean Water Declaration, and we can't let them drill even one time on our land here in Florida.
Thank
we'll
you, Anita.
A bunch of wells here.
What I'm going to do now is I'm going to open up the floor to for everyone to answer some questions. And the first question I want to ask, Emily, welcome back.
Thanks.
And the first question, this is a question Alan asked me to raise for each of you. And I need you to make the quickest possible response because we've got several questions we'd want to get through for everyone between now and 9 o'clock. So first question, this is Alan's question. In Alan's opinion, peace is much more effective way to combat climate change than switching out light bulbs, and a movement that should be created for peace and environmental movement to come together and fight the military-industrial complex, and he thinks that would have an enormous impact. How do you feel that the peace movement and the environmental movement need to relate? So let me first ask Emine, could you your thoughts about that?
Peace movement and the environmental movement?
Right. Do they have a common purpose there?
Well, of course. I mean, it's they both, I think, all about nonviolence. And to me, all this assault to our environment, it is a form of a war. You know, the mountaintop removals, all this leaks, coal ash. We cannot have a peaceful world without drinking water. So definitely, I mean, they're related, if that's the question he's asking, but they can work together, of course.
Thank you. Let me ask Tony. Tony, your reaction to the work, how can the peace movement and the environmental movement work together in the hopes that that'll make the environmental movement even more effective?
Well, as many of us know, you know, here in the U.S., our biggest user of the energy industry is the military-industrial complex. So in order to end or to look to alternative forms of energy, the first thing that we need to look to is who are the biggest users of the traditional forms of energy. And basically what we're doing with energy is enabling war. So sure, yeah, there's definitely a big connection.
Thank you. Alan, your thoughts on this?
Well, I wrote an article in Canadian Dimension. People can read it if they want. It was a response to an article they did about an interview with Noam Chomsky. My position is that not only does the military consume enormous amounts of energy, which leaves a huge carbon footprint, but the military-industrial complex, the entire complex, from mining to manufacturing, all of this, creating these armaments and everything, this is a huge carbon footprint. Even forestry, we have to chop down, you know, millions and millions of trees to rebuild in the aftermath of these wars. So you've got the manufacturing leading up to wars, you've got the wars themselves, and you've got the rebuilding after the war. All of this manufacturing and this industry is a huge carbon footprint, and this is where I think the environmental movement and the peace movements have to come together.
Thank you, sir.
The labor movement to take a position either.
Good idea. Anita, your thoughts on the environmental movement and the peace movement working together?
Well, as a veteran myself, what I can say and echo the others speaking here is bring the troops home now, end all wars, and let's put together green jobs for our returning veterans and for everybody else that needs work. We could put a solar panel on every single home on this planet if we had our troops home, if we end the wars. And the military-industrial complex, which is just like a giant leech sucking the life's blood out of all of us, I would say green jobs are probably the most important thing as an alliance between the military-industrial complex and the environmental movement.
Thank you. Okay, I've got a question for you all, and then we'll go through the one by one on this. You know, it seems that In the effort to close Guantanamo, the president has decided on a policy that instead of trying people who he believes have acted against the United States, we'll just kill them with a drone missile. No justice, no court, no prisoners in Guantanamo. We'll just kill them. And I was wondering how you feel about that as the new justice theory. First, let me ask. I'll start with Anita on this one.
Well, that's murder. I think that was authorized by the NDAA, and people need to understand that we should have never, as citizens of the United States, we should have never allowed that law to even be approved. I'm not understanding why people weren't in the streets protesting that en masse, which is really what should have happened. So, it's murder.
Alan, your thoughts on drones as a new form of justice?
Well, it's just plain old savagery and barbarity. There's no justice at all involved. It's complete injustice. It's murder. And, you know, Barack Obama should be put on trial as a war criminal for carrying out these drone attacks.
Yep, along with Bush and Cheney. Thanks.
Exactly.
Tony. Thanks. Tony, your reaction, sir?
Yeah, I'm not going to add too much in the way of new thought on this. I think I think the answer is fairly obvious. What concerns me as a longtime journalist and as someone who you know is doing his best to foment a response to what's going on is what Anita was just saying, which is the lack of any kind of public outcry. You know, part of that is because it was suppressed and sugarcoated by the mainstream media. But at some point, we have to wonder what does it take to get people into the streets. And you know, the unfortunate answer to that, I think, is that the longer it takes, the more upheaval we are going to see when it finally does happen.
Okay, and that brings me to Emily.
Yeah, it's really nothing to do with justice, and it is actually against the United States founding principles of, you know, due process and, you know, the right to life. To me, it creates more terrorism, so it has the opposite effect of whatever they're trying to do. And the only reason people are not on the streets, I think, because they're not very knowledgeable of the details of NDAA and the background of it. So I think that's our job as journalists to bring that information forward.
You know, I've heard several people say to me, you know, look, you know, when we use drones, there's no troops put at risk. When we use drones, you know, there's not people stacking up at Guantanamo. And I have to say, you know, I remember back when we used to be concerned about international law. Mm-hmm. I remember when we used to be concerned about due process. Yeah. And, you know, the president may have made a quip about due process between him and the attorney general, but that's not what the founders saw was due process. Okay, next question I was going to ask. I'd like you all to weigh in. Do you think the president's going to, in fact, approve the de facto use of the Keystone Pipeline? Let me start with Emily.
I think he will, and that's a shame.
Thank you. Tony?
Yeah, I definitely believe that he will. I agree with Emily. It's it is indeed a shame, and it's breathtaking to me how certain environmental groups are still of the opinion that it is not going to get approved. Very frankly.
Thank you, Alan.
Well, I think Obama will approve it for sure, even if he doesn't. The pipeline companies, oil companies, are just like the mining companies. They take a very long view. If they don't think they can get it passed right now, they'll wait for the next president to come along, you know, and they'll try and get it passed.
Thank you, sir. Anita?
I believe it has everything to do with the money, and I believe it has to do with big oil running everything, and, yeah, I believe it'll be approved.
Thank you. The next question I'm going to ask you is, you know, there's been just hour after hour after hour after hour of speculation on the Christie bridge / traffic / corruption bullying issue. How long do you think the press is going to be mesmerized by this? Let me start with Anita.
I think the media... what the mainstream media, what they do is find a story to attack someone to divert attention from stories that really need to be covered. And what happened with Christie was just a friggin' traffic jam. Let's get over it and start talking about stuff that really matters, like, you know, the drought in California and lots of other important topics.
Thank you. Alan?
I'm not really up on what happened with that bridge scandal.
Well, really, it's a tempest in a teapot, that's for sure. No problem, sir.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. I'm going to turn this around. What do you think is the most untold story right now in the American press?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Okay, I think poverty and these wars, the media is almost ignoring the wars at this point, and we're not hearing about poverty. Poverty is one of the major problems in this country, and we've heard no solutions at all. There's no discussion in the media about why we even have poverty.
Thank you. Tony, your reaction to the, should we say, the filling of the airwaves with speculation about Christie?
Well, I think the way you originally phrased your question, and correct me if I'm wrong, Rick, was, you know, how long will the media continue to be mesmerized by this story? They'll continue to be mesmerized by this story until both of the major corporate parties are put out of business, because it's their job to continue broadcasting these kinds of stories so that those two parties can remain in business. That's all I have on that.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Emini, your reaction to this, I don't know if you've even heard about this silly story.
A little bit, yeah. And actually, that was a meme, one of those memes that circulates in Facebook, and I was really funny. That's how I learned about it. And it was Christie's picture, and he was saying, I didn't mean to close the bridge. I meant to close the fridge. The fridge. I was talking about a fridge. So I was like, what is he saying? So I checked it, and I learned a little bit about it. But I think the original focus was because I think he was considered one of the 2016 contenders for the presidential bid for the GOP, I think. So he's kind of like the, you know, bad boy of the GOP right now. So that was the focus originally, I think. And I also definitely agree with Anita about when they don't have, they just want to, you know, put this back and forth, instead of focusing on actually what's going on. Dan River leak, for example. How many, you said CNN covered Dan River leak, the coal ash leak, like once?
Yes.
That's it, right?
Yep.
So, and they don't even, they cover it simply, and they don't even actually mention, you're not going to hear them mention, for example, the governor, North Carolina governor, Pat McCrory, worked for Duke Energy for 28 years, so they're not going to mention that. So I believe that they're using it as an excuse to cover, you know, other major stories. I agree with Anita on that.
Thank you. Okay, the next question I want to ask you is, you know, the steady drumbeat attacks on Roe v. Wade, on limiting women's access. Is this the year that they absolutely shut down women's access to birth control and or contraception? And let me start with you, Emini.
No, I don't think they will ever be able to, you know, shut down. But that's, as someone who lived in four different countries, and now, as I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, what's happening in Spain, I think this is just conservative government, their obsession with it. And it's one of their platform, it's in their, you know, ideology. They just work on it, and then there's going to be a backlash. There are going to be enough feminists, and there are going to be enough women's rights activists, male and female, you know, work against it. And so I don't think the laws are going to change, but we have to work very, very hard on it to keep the status quo.
Thank you. Tony?
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree. I think that it's primarily an issue that conservatives use to rally their base. I really do not see Roe v. Wade being reversed or really threatened at the national level. Frankly, what scares me is the chilling effect that some of the legislation that is being passed in the states is having in terms of closing clinics that are not close enough to an ER because they've upgraded the facility to a medical facility that requires, you know, a hospital affiliation. There are a lot of sneaky ways that women's rights to what they want to do with their own bodies are being curtailed. And in every case, whenever the right gets a victory on those issues, it rallies their base, and then it's a very short step to creationism. and then we're really in trouble.
We'll have Bill Nye take care of that.
Alan, your thoughts?
Well, I agree with all the others. I would just add that I think it shows that whenever progressives make gains, we have to be prepared constantly to defend those gains, and this is one of those issues.
Thank you, sir. Anita?
I agree with Alan on that one. We can never let our guard down. We have to constantly be vigilant, and we have to be ready for the onslaught, you know, from the conservative wing of our corporatist government. The right to for women to make their own choice is supposed to be guaranteed by our law currently, but it seems like the there's real moves to take it away from us in little bits and pieces. Planned Parenthood and other groups like that are very powerful lobbyists, and they have a lot of watchdogs that are watching. That are watching D.C. and other state governments on this issue, and I believe it will continue. But we can't let our guard down even for 5 minutes. We have
you know,
to be
it just
watching.
Seems to be, it seems to be so pathetic. You know, I mean, the fight for contraception was 100 years ago. You know, the fight for Roe v. Wade has, you know, has been decades and decades and decades. You know, and I appreciate the fact that you're saying we have to keep fighting. But my goodness, you know, I mean, this is zombie apocalypse all over again for issues that have been all resolved.
Right.
Which brings me to another related topic, I'm afraid. I don't know if you've noticed, but the Newsmax news service is all over the progressive press. Their advertisements, their story links is it shows up on Talking Points Memo. It shows up on Huffington Post. It shows up. I mean, there must be 10 different progressive sites that I look at that the right-wing Newsmax news clips are showing up as advertisements. I find this amazing. And the other thing I want to tell you and get your reaction on is just recently I've seen several different, quote, major CEOs complaining about the lynching that's going on of these poor fellows that are making so much money and bailed out by the taxpayers. I saw they were on the news this morning. Has anyone seen that stuff? The public lynching of corrupt, overpaid CEOs. Anita?
I have not been watching that too closely. What I have seen is that a lot of these bankers have shown up dead or suicided.
Yes.
But I haven't been looking at the other as much, so I really couldn't comment on that.
No problem. Alan?
Well, that's about what I've been seeing, too, the bankers jumping and who knows how they're dying. I think it's pretty obvious there's a massive scandal brewing.
Thank you. Tony?
Yeah, I agree. And you know, in terms of Newsmax in particular, it's no coincidence that you know, a conservative site is showing up in progressive places around the internet. Their stock and trade is to incite conversation, to get eyeballs to their site so they can increase their advertising and increase their reach. So you know, it's basically a game that is being played, and in the end, to me, it only perpetuates the duopoly. It really doesn't speak in any kind of a comprehensive way as to the problems that we face that are much more broad and deep.
Emily, your reaction to these this complaints by the rich that they're being put upon?
It's very interesting because a few years ago I did a research and an article on it, and strangely, I can't even remember my article title right now on how what kind of personality traits one needs to possess in order to be an executive in Wall Street, for example, or top-level CEO. And I found out that most of them are very selfish, first of all, self-motivated, and they do have very similar personality traits to sociopaths. Basically, there. If I can find that link, I'll send it to you.
Thanks.
So I'm really not surprised that they are this indifferent and they're that callous towards the actual working people and the poor, because they can't connect, and they because that will require them to acknowledge what the criminal acts they're doing to hurt these people. You know, how many people lost their pensions? How many people lost their homes because of the Wall Street? Gambling. So it does require, and I think they're naturally just sociopaths. They don't relate. They don't get it.
You know, I heard one of these guys complaining this morning on one of the major talk shows, and he said, you know, these people are so greedy. You know, they want more money for minimum wage. If they want more money, they should just get more skills. And, you know, of course, that's so disconnected from reality because we've got a lot of people with a lot of skills who are being forced, and that's the only jobs that are available to them. He said, well, there's just nobody who's heading a household and being forced to be paid minimum wage, which, again, you know, just absolutely flies in the face of reality.
I know, and that old argument about, oh, if we, you know, we can't afford to raise the minimum wage and that'll affect our products, for example, products and services, it's going to, you know, we have to charge more for our customers. And then, but they can't afford to pay their CEOs $24 million and then next year $33 million, but they cannot give people a little bit more. So it's just a really, like I said, if I can find that link, I'll send it to you, that they do have that personality trait. They can't relate. They don't just get it. They don't get it.
Thank you. The next question, I'm going to turn back to the environment. And, you know, we've seen the spills. We've seen the train derailments. We've seen the ash spill in North Carolina. We've seen the chemical spills in West Virginia, the fracking incidents, the earthquakes. Do you think there's a chance that there'll be a serious environmental backlash to this absolute abuse of the planet? Let me start with Anita.
Yes, I believe it's already happening. We can see the sea rise. We can see the people sick in the Gulf region. People in West Virginia have been hospitalized. There's birth defects. We have Fukushima, which is still spouting toxins and irradiation. And now people in California, I mean, I don't know about you all, anybody here from Florida, but I'm not buying produce from California or Washington State or Oregon. I've stopped doing that because I'm too afraid that it's probably contaminated. This and the chemical oil spill in West Virginia, Fukushima, and the Gulf oil spill are three of the biggest environmental stories that are the most unreported on.
Thank you. Let me go and pass the baton to Alan. Alan, your reaction, is there a chance that people will finally organize on these environmental issues?
I think people, from what I see here in Minnesota, people are organizing. We have thousands and thousands of people turning off for these public hearings on the environmental impact statements for the sulfide mine. People are mad about this fracking. I mean, all over this country, we're not getting the full story of the involvement of so many citizens in this country when it comes to the fracking issue and these other environmental issues. People are getting together. We're seeing citizen activism increasing around this environment, around all these environmental issues. And I don't think there's any question that this is going to be one of the most important movements creating change in this country.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Tony, you're in the heart of it right now. You're in North Carolina.
Yes, I am. I'm up to my neck in coal ash. I mentioned a little bit earlier in the conversation here that what really concerned me is how there are some environmentalists who still are holding out hope that the pipeline will not get approved. I really hope, Bill McKibben at 350.org, his organization is an ally of the NPAs of my organization, and we've really worked hard to sort of hold his feet to the fire. McKibben admits to being a somewhat new activist in terms of his experience. But the best thing 350.org and other organizations of that ilk could be doing right now is preparing for massive street protests once the pipeline is approved, because I really think that if Obama approves it, and I fully expect him to, that the public response is going to be what determines how seriously we're taking these environmental issues.
Thank you, sir. Emily, your reaction, is there a tipping point now that there'll be any environmental rallies?
Yes, of course. And I think the social media is really helping. Like this 350.org and the other organizations, they are able to connect in a very swift way and then get together and share information. And like Anita said, once people are personally affected, their, you know, home values go down and their drinking water, you know, they can't drink the water anymore, then they're going to start, you know, rallying it. And I see it. I see it already. And with the social networks, it's getting faster and people are getting together, definitely.
I want to tell you a little story that I heard yesterday from my colleague in Tokyo. This is Toby Marshall, who works with the German public television doing the documentaries over there. He said the Japanese environmental movement used to be really strong, and the government has done everything it can to oppress it. They've got a new official secrets law. And he said, well, right now the anti-nuke movement in Japan is quiescent. But if something happens, he said, if something really happens, then maybe it'll get together again. I said, my God, Toby, my God, if something needs to happen more than Fukushima, what will it take if Fukushima is not enough? And I just found that heartbreaking. But I want to thank you all for joining me tonight. It's been wonderful to have you, to have your understanding, your experience, your insight. Thanks so much, and I want to thank each of you, Anita, Alan, Tony, Emily. We had Hans and Dennis as well. But I'm going to leave you one closing remark. Anita, your final thoughts. Please be brief.
It's going to take all of us. We have to band together, and we have to be solid. And I'd really like to see the Occupy movement rise up again and cover all of these issues as they did before, without getting co-opted by other groups. It has to have one mind think on these issues and go for it.
Alan, your thoughts?
Well, I'm very encouraged. I think progressives are getting together. We see here in Minnesota a woman named Lena Boggs running for state representative in California. We see Cindy Sheehan running for governor. This is all very encouraging, and I think we've got to support these kinds of candidates and come together.
Thank you, sir. Tony.
Yes, I agree with everything that's been said thus far. I would just like to add that, you know, progressives have a wonderful opportunity every 2 years to run for House seats in the U.S. House of Representatives every 2 years, and the degree to which we do not avail ourselves of that opportunity is just heartbreaking.
Thank you. And, Emily, your thoughts?
Don't lose hope. Stand up for what you believe. You have the right, and you have the power.
Thanks so much. And good night, my friends. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Rick.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for having us.
Okay. I also want to thank my other – bye-bye. I want to thank my fellow progressive broadcasters, Gwen Holden Berry and her show Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton and his show Progress Toward Democracy, Anita Stewart and her show Wise Women Media, Susan Nylon, The Nylon Report, Sita Biguil, Sita Media, and, of course, Harriet Lerman, The Voice of the People. Thanks again. Thank you all. And we'll leave you with some music.
I don't want millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back my job again.
Now I don't want your Rolls Royce, mister. I don't want your pleasure yacht. My old job back. We worked to build this country, mister, while you enjoyed a life of ease. You've stolen all that we built, mister. Now our children starve and freeze.
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back my job again.
Think me dumb if you wish, mister. Call me green or blue. This one thing I sure know, mister, My hungry babies must be fed. Take the two old parties, mister. No difference in them I can see. But with a farmer labor party, we could set the people free. So
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back